Well, hi, and welcome back to the RoboPsych Podcast. I'm Tom Guariello, here as always with my co-host, Carla Diana. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Tom. It is great to be here, and I'm excited about our guest today.
As am I, because today we have Dr. Scott Nowicki as our guest on the RoboPsych Podcast. Scott, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, Scott is a remote sensing expert and the lead R&D scientist at Quantum Spatial, and been involved in a variety of incredibly interesting and diverse projects, ranging from the Mars rover to the Gobi Desert to structural integrity of materials. And so we're very eager to talk with Scott today about the use of robotics in another of these applications that is not directly consumer-facing. Many of our guests here on the podcast have been creators of social robots and interaction kinds of robots and a whole range of anthropomorphic kinds of robots. And Scott, you're involved in a whole different domain, and so it's really interesting to have you on the show today. So I understand that you're a geologist by training. Is that right?
I am. So yeah, I've come a long way between kind of like exploring Mars and working on rocks in the field to building robots that go in substations.
Awesome.
So maybe we could start at the beginning. What was it about geology that got you interested in the first place?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's funny, when I was in high school, I really didn't have a plan. No high schooler typically has a plan, but I knew I needed to look at colleges, figure out some criteria for judging colleges, and I kind of liked physics. I certainly like being outside, and somehow in my head, I combined this, I should be a planetary geologist, study Mars, use physics and all of these different tools in order to understand this other planet, but in order to be a good planetary geologist, because you don't get to go to these planets, you need to spend some time on Earth. I actually said I would go to like this classic geology school, and so I went to this little liberal arts college, Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, and really got the fundamentals in like paleontology and field work and stratigraphic mapping and all these things. And then I was surprised at how like ideal that field suited me. And then I went off to Arizona State to get my master's and PhD in remote sensing and really kind of Mars exploration. So it was this kind of random decision that I made early on because I combined these things that I liked.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be a totally great choice.
So going to Arizona State from Augustana, Illinois, what kind of geological variation did you find there in those two settings?
Oh yeah, it's way different. It's funny because recently the Augustana reached out to me during COVID time. They're doing a lot of stuff online, like connecting people with alumni, and so I kind of advised a student on a project he was working on. But then I saw the kind of work that's being done in Illinois, and it's like they're looking at gravel deposits and they're looking at kind of glacial features, not real bedrock and not like the most exciting of geology. Uh-huh. So that shift from glacial terrain and farm fields to Arizona is just wonderland of geologic phenomena, right? The rocks are amazing. The history is crazy. There's a lot in the backyard to do. And then there's the Grand Canyon. There is basalt flows. There's like so much more diversity within the Southwest that I knew at that point that I had made the right decision.
Cool. And when did things click for you around robotics? Like, was there a moment that you realized that, I can get my head around these tools and in fact, I can make better tools for discovery and exploration?
Yeah, robotics has been an interesting path because I never would have expected that I would wind up in the situation that I'm in. So my real experience with robotics in grad school was I was part of the team that built two different hyperspectral thermal cameras that went on the 2003 Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity.
Wow.
So we built the instruments and then kind of designed the protocol for how do you really use them to do science on Mars? And these are very specific. They're kind of thermal oriented. So we're looking for temperature changes. We're also looking for compositional variation. And you can actually use that to navigate hazards as well as to interpret the geology of the surface. And so my early robotic experience was like, how do you really just building these instruments and then using that to do science on the surface where it's not entirely autonomous? Like on Mars, for most of these rovers, it's kind of like you make the decision of what's going to happen that day, and maybe the rover goes 15 feet, right? It doesn't actually necessarily have to be that. It navigates autonomously, but it's not like it's traveling long distances and really operating at high speeds. So it was more like, what do you do to get the scientific observations that you need in order to solve these problems? And so that was kind of my robot experience. It was working with these amazing engineers at NASA and JPL that built these things. But it was really more about what are the instruments you need in order to solve the problems that we're trying to identify. So once those missions were over, I kind of took a step away from robotics and did a lot of work on different environmental mapping projects. Like worked in the Mojave Desert to be able to determine the physical characteristics of the surface to be able to model species habitat for lizards and turtles and those kinds of things. And then I got involved in a few other projects of like, how do you use satellite information in order to, really it's mostly environmental issues. And then when I joined Quantum Spatial in 2014, mostly working with airborne sensors, so things that are going on planes, sometimes helicopters, with a mix of satellite information in there, I got further and further into what are the higher resolution observations you can make. So the natural progression was to go to drones and started flying drones to be able to do lots of inspection of infrastructure, but also really high resolution observations of environments to be able to kind of solve the problems that humans on the ground, that it's difficult for humans on the ground to actually solve, right? Doing traditional field work is very labor intensive, and it's a function of what you see, where you're walking around and what you can observe from that vantage point. So an aerial perspective, kind of scanning surfaces gives you consistent information that is quantifiable, and you can really use that to build a better understanding of a three-dimensional environment.
You know, I'm a psychologist. And so, when I hear you talk about the instrumentation that you have developed and that you have worked with, I always think about, Marshall McLuhan's, description of technology as an extension of the body. And in this case of an extension of the senses the ability to develop the kinds of instruments that perceive the world at orders of magnitude levels of difference than human perception is very difficult for us to imagine as, you know, embodied people. I guess my question is, how does the wonder of what you do, how does that stay with you, or does it just become mundane to be able to do things of this kind?
Oh no, it's pretty fantastic, and to operate at different scales, like I use satellite data to look at volcanoes in certain locations, and I use ultra high resolution imagery in a substation in order to map these features. This range of scales going from hundreds of meters down to millimeters, and then the diversity of environments going from the Gobi Desert, right? Natural and as untouched by humans as a surface really can be, all the way to like electrical infrastructure, makes it pretty interesting just to have this diversity of observations. But in the end, I'm still a geologist. It comes back to I think about the geologic time scale, about deep time, about how processes are moving around. The ocean is constantly changing the shoreline in a way that if a human standing on the surface just looks at it, all they do is see is waves. As you take a step back in time, you can see variations that start to occur. And so having that perspective of like time is changing things slowly, so you have to think in longer terms in order to really understand what's going on, is I think gives me it provides a perspective that makes all of this stuff so much more interesting as we continue to add more and more observations to our kind of our worldview. And the worldview is changing, right? When I got my PhD, it was, climate change is occurring and people are aware that it's occurring, but the speed and degree of change that is going to occur as a function of it was really not well understood. Now, a decade or two later, even it becomes so much more important to understand these scales and these processes that are affecting our lives, that kind of changes the way we look at the world and the types of observations you want to make, and thinking about small scale, large scale is all an important part of it. So that's kind of a rambling answer to the question, but yeah, it's fun.
So how do you deal with the enormous technical hurdles that I'm sure you encounter? I had a friend, Zach Ratting, who would work on projects like this. And at one point he had an Arctic camera and he started describing just all the things that happen with batteries and lenses and, you know, and you're dealing with moving parts on top of it. I'm sure you hit some pretty enormous walls in the challenge with your work. So can you talk a little bit about that and how you work past that?
Yeah. So what I tend to do is, it's certainly an R&D type of thing, right? The robots that we're building in substations we have a bunch of them and they're operating pretty well, but really my job is to solve those problems. How do you actually get the technology to work and then to interface with humans in a way that makes it useful? And the other projects that I'm involved with, we're doing a lot of volcano monitoring all over the world, putting CO2 sensors on these drones and then flying it up into the plume to be able to measure a good measurement of the pure gas that's coming out of the volcano in order to build a predictive model. Like that as well is like, we run into all these problems of like, sure, it sounds reasonable to put a CO2 sensor in a drone and fly it into a volcano, but
sure,
volcanoes
no problem,
can be big, they can be windy, it can be rough surfaces, you can have all sorts of, you know, shear winds and other things that are occurring.
Probably pretty hot.
Well, we're typically up above the heat, so we're trying to stay away from the hottest point. But again, like all of these, right, there are all of these technological limitations to these things. And that's kind of my niche. It's like, if it's something that someone else doesn't already have an off-the-shelf product, that's what I do, because I've got a team of pretty good people who are able to help me both build the technology and kind of write the software to be able to make it mostly functional. And then you kind of throw this human element into it of like solving problems on a moment by moment scale. When you're out on a field campaign, there's only so many resources that you have. Building the right tools requires a whole lot of flexibility. And assuming that you don't have all the problems solved before you actually go out in the field or go into the station.
That was a question that I had thinking about our conversation today was roughly what percentage of what you end up utilizing is off the shelf, and what percentage do you have to, like, you know, actually create yourselves?
The majority of what we're using is, I would say, off the shelf, but nothing is really, you can't buy a whole system. That's what we at Quantum are doing. We are selling a whole system, a robotic system that allows people to inspect substations. But we can't purchase anything that is off the shelf. We're not going to make a thermal camera. We're not going to make even a robotic platform is something that there's enough robot producers out there that there is a good platform that you can find. But it's integrating those off the shelf sensors into a navigable, autonomous, reliable, package that is where we're, that's where all of the effort is to build the hardware, all of the hardware, and then to build the software that pulls it all together in a way that it actually makes it useful. Very little of this is that we're kind of building these things from scratch, but in the end, there's so much effort that goes into actually integrating that's plenty of work.
You alluded to your team. First of all, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about Quantum Spatial as a company, and then we can talk a little bit more specifically about who you work with most closely in your team.
So Quantum Spatial is owned by, we were recently purchased by a engineering firm, NV5. So we are the geospatial arm of a large, mostly civil engineering type entity. And what we do is provide geospatial solutions for all sorts of different clients. It could be government clients, the USGS, NOAA, aerial imagery, aerial LIDAR, but we build these spatial data sets that are necessary for what kind of maintaining the country as it currently operates. And a lot of the work that my division does, the kind of the private side of Quantum, is to do this kind of work for utilities. So we fly lots of LIDAR over power lines to tell where power lines are, where are the trees that are growing into it, where are all the hazards that are associated with transmission and distribution lines, and then giving that information to the utilities to be able to manage vegetation or manage outages in a wildfire situation, to like take all of the information and put it together into a package that allows people to manage infrastructure when it's surrounded by the natural environment. So my group in particular, we do kind of emerging solutions. And so for a long time, I was working on hyperspectral imagery to identify tree species using airborne systems. And then once we kind of spun that off, we pivoted to other things. And one of those things was building robots to be able to maintain facilities.
So can I just interrupt you there for a second? Because that sentence was just fascinating to me. You identify tree species from spectral instrumentation. How many arborists did you have in your team? I'm really fascinated with that aspect of it.
Oh, good question.
Yeah. It's a funny relationship. Typically what I do, like my role is to deal with an entity that comes to us, a client that will come to us and say, we understand some aspect of this. We understand how to maintain vegetation over power lines. What we want is this very specific piece of information that we don't know how to get at. So it was actually the vegetation management groups that said, we're the arborists, we know how to deal with trees, but we don't know, tell us the species of every one of these trees along thousands of miles of power line. So, you know, find the tree, tell us how big it is, how close it is to the wire, and then tell us what the species is. And ideally, tell us how healthy it is. And so we said, sure, we can do that. But it was really working with the experts who have this goal in mind. And all of the projects that I've worked on, when that relationship is in place, where there's an expert on the client side, we're the experts on the geospatial information side, and it comes together to produce a result that's actually highly applicable and useful for these clients, because they know they need it. They're asking for this solution. And it was the same thing with the substations. It was the lead engineer for innovation who said, I want a robot in a substation that can do this, 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 and this. And so I went out with him into a substation and he said, can you see that with a robot? Can you do this with a robot? And we kind of made this list of activities and then proceeded to design a system that solved those problems from the kind of the engineer, the innovation engineer point of view, and the geospatial / exploration kind of side of things.
Yeah.
So most of the time, like that's how you build a good project. You got knowledge on one side and knowledge on the other side, and you kind of bring it all together.
Yeah, it sounds like a fantastic partnership where you're right, both bringing a depth of knowledge to the same goal. Can you tell us more about working with space as an environment?
Space is tough.
Because
humans don't operate very well in space. But it's interesting to think about space exploration and what we do on Earth and compare those models. Mm. I would say almost most of the time when I go into the field to do something, it's kind of like a mission where you're going to this location that you have some amount of information about. If we're going to go to Mars, we have kind of some good remote sensing data to be able to kind of bracket our observations and guess at what's going to be there. And then driving a rover around on the surface is to look for very particular things that we can identify, but also to just see what's there to know that we're not missing some huge problem.
We were looking at the presentation that you recently gave, which, you know, is a highly technical presentation, at least, you know, to my eyes, and that's a very relative term. But that was a presentation about the way robots are being used in wildfire control and in hurricane preparedness. Could you tell our listeners more about how work that you're doing can impact their lives in those kinds of domains?
Yeah. The problems that we're seeing across the country right now are certainly a function of the climate. Climate is changing. It's causing trees to fail, trees to die. It is causing fires to occur. It's causing flooding in Miami. It's causing hurricanes that are hitting the Gulf Coast. So there are all these problems associated with kind of this changing environment. And those environments are impacting our infrastructure in ways that are becoming more and more extreme. And so if you live in California, wildfires are causing either the power to get shut off before fires occur, or power is going down because of wildfires that are destroying substations or transmission lines. So it's like this, trying to deal with this infrastructure that is more and more susceptible to environmental issues is a huge part of my job, because we don't have the tools available in order to do it right now. So building new tools in order to be able to support infrastructure resilience in the future is becoming more and more important as more and more issues start to crop up. So using autonomous platforms, whether it's robots or drones or just sensors that are placed randomly through the environment, those tools allow us to both measure what's going on in terms of the environment and then prepare to deal with fixing the infrastructure once a problem occurs. And so right now, we've got a bunch of robots that are in Florida in substations that are getting slammed by multiple hurricanes per year. Mm-hmm. And the idea is if you have a persistent observation in a substation, then when the hurricane comes through and it knocks, when it does something, could knock down a tree, could flood the station, could whatever, just kind of break some hardware that's there. If there is no good observation of what's in the substation, then it's going to take someone from the utility to drive out to that station, take a look at what's there, make a note of what they need to get, go back to headquarters, fill out to decide what kind of infrastructure to send. Do they need to send a mobile substation? Do they just need to go and flip the switch? So it's this unknown that could be on the order of hours to days to be able to get to a substation. And it's a similar thing in a wildfire scenario, right? Yeah, yeah. The wildfire passes a substation and knocks it out. It could be something just got too hot and melted. It could be a tree fell down. It could be anything. So if you know immediately after an event what happened in a station or in a facility, then you can immediately say, instead of sending somebody out to actually inspect, you can just send the solution to the problem and save potentially days.
There's the key, isn't it? The amount of impact that these events have on our daily lives is really where your work really affects all of us on a day-to-day basis, huh? You know, I'm struck by, I'm going to just call it the casual way in which you talk about climate change and the impact of climate change and how dramatically that way of talking about your work is contrasted by the way we hear our leadership talking about these issues as if there's some kind of question about what's happening and so on. How do those conversations strike you as a professional working in this world every day?
I agree with you that there is this funny relationship between those who are theoretically in charge and those who are actually preparing for the future. And this goes across the board in government agencies, Forest Service and Bureau of Reclamation and USGS. From the very top, for a while, they were told that they could not say climate change. And at the same time, the Bureau of Reclamation in the southwestern United States was building models to determine just how climate change was going to affect water resources and power delivery. Like there's no doubt that when you actually have to deal with it, it's real. Of course, we're seeing the effects right now. So you actually have to plan for it especially when you're talking about billions of dollars worth of infrastructure, you're not going to go into that blindly and pretend like it doesn't exist when you're seeing the effects on a daily basis. So that's government. And then on the utility side, these are businesses that sell us power and keep infrastructure running. All of the major utilities are preparing for climate change. There's no doubt about it. Like the robot program is because we know that climate is changing. Hurricanes are hitting the Gulf Coast and we have to be prepared for it. And one after another, the real leaders of industry are well aware that this is occurring and taking action in order to deal with it, because it's huge investments that we're talking about. When it comes to political leaders, they can say that because they're not actually in charge of keeping the lights on when the climate continues to change. So there is a very serious disconnect between those who are actually doing the work and those who are kind of making the decisions on the government or legislative side.
And we don't typically have political conversations on the RoboPsych podcast, but I wonder. It's almost inevitable in a conversation like this to ask this question, which is: I wonder how could leaders at every level make your work easier or more effective?
That is a good question. And I'm not entirely sure how to answer it. So many of the leaders that I see are the leaders of industry and infrastructure. And they are using the best available information in order to make reasonable choices for the future. But in each of those cases, it's only what they have control over. For these utilities, it's just how do you deliver power safely to people as the environment starts to go haywire. What I think where we do not have action is preparing for the future in a way that is beyond those investment possibilities, right? So real changes to the way food and power and stuff gets distributed throughout the United States is it's more than just a single or even a couple industries. It is broader than that. So really a plan for the future would be really predicting how does a changing climate affect the larger scale system, and what are the systemic changes we can actually make in order to make that to make us a bit more resilient. You know, there's lots of work done on this. We know what can be done. It's not like it's an unknown. But I think the fact that we do have leaders, political leaders that are making these statements that climate change is not occurring or that it's not bad, is directly antithetical to the efforts that are going on in industries across the U.S. or across the world. I don't necessarily have a good solution for how to make my job easier. But there certainly is no doubt there are lots of solutions out there. As long as a systemic approach is taken, which is, we have not seen.
So, I was wondering, what do you see on the horizon in terms of the technology that you work with that is near future potential that would make the work easier, deeper, more sophisticated? Like, what's the near future technology? And I'm sure there's starting to be a lot of use of perhaps machine learning around, especially camera vision and analyzing the data that you're taking in.
So the technology that is becoming most useful. Sure, machine learning is great, and being able to identify features and images, it's useful. But really, it's this connection between operations and all of this kind of new data, and how you're able to take new information and give it to the right people to be able to make the right decisions. And in some cases, it's just the lineman that's working on a power line. How do you take machine learning and produce something that he can actually use? So it's really this interface between humans and this robotic autonomous machine vision system. And at Quantum Spatial, we do a good job of like building geospatial information to be able to inform those working in the field, right? So it's a map or a three-dimensional view of something that allows people to better understand the environment in which they're navigating. And so it's going to be whatever, AR, VR, these kinds of things are going to be useful. But I think it's more training people to be able to use information that before was on a spreadsheet or on a piece of paper. It's building ways for those who are in the O&M, on the O&M side of things, to actually be able to utilize products from these kind of fancy tools. But at the same time, there are more observations that need to be made in order to really make this work well. So like one really a related problem that I'm working on is using autonomous platforms to be able to measure gas emissions. And so we're doing this for volcanoes, right? We're flying drones into volcanoes to be able to measure gas. And we're building drone swarms that are able to fly into kind of this big plume and then follow it down to the point where it's coming out of the ground. And then taking that and applying it to methane emissions that are occurring at pipelines. Right? There's all sorts of methane that's burping out all over the place from our aging infrastructure. And same thing, if we can take these drone swarms and put them on that problem, then all of a sudden we can find where these leaks are occurring that are a majority of the anthropogenic methane that's being produced on the globe. So it's like finding the new ways to use the same tools, gas sensors and autonomous platforms, but to specifically look at problems that we know are occurring, that currently you can't have somebody driving around with a methane sensor and actually be effective at all, right? You need to use autonomous methods in order to really make that functional in the system that we currently operate. And I think this idea of like finding the right observations to make it work for all of these different entities is really where we're going to see a whole lot of value coming soon.
You know, it's fascinating. You've just described both aspects of what I think of as the socio-technical systems that are needed in order to maintain resilience within any kind of a complex system that you're dealing with. And so, you know, here you just address the technical developments that would enable you to gather more data. And then, but you started off by talking about the, if you will, the data visualization, or the, you know, how do we get the user to understand, you know, what's going on? We're used to things like, you know, dashboards on cars, you know, that give us that, you know, hey, that warning light is on, that red light is on, oh, you're in the green, you're in the yellow, you're in the red, you know, those kinds of data interface methodologies, I'm sure are critical to the work that you do, huh?
But yeah, how you actually represent information about issues that are occurring within environment or human stuff is a huge problem when people are, they have very different experiences. Everyone's accustomed to a smartphone. Maybe we're getting pretty comfortable with autonomous features in a vehicle, but there are so many different ways to show information that is kind of within major industries, right? Actual transportation, like how you actually deal with cars on the road and where, what their position is relative to each other. It's got to be a very simplified system in order to actually interface with the human. There's all these kind of hidden things, but building that understanding of like, here's the feedback that you're getting, how you actually deal with it in the real world is going to change. It's going to be interesting to see it evolve.
Yeah, and actionable data, right? Too. I mean, that's the other part of it. You can give me every bit of literally all the bits that you have of all that information flow. But you know what? What I can do about what I see is really all you care about, huh? Is portraying to me the actionable sphere that is in my control that will have an impact on the outcomes that we're trying to enable. That's a hell of a design challenge to get into Carla's domain. That is a hell of a design challenge.
Mm-hmm. It's a holy grail.
Yep, and it'll be interesting to see how that changes as as the technology gets better, but as more and more industries or groups embrace this technology, right? It's like I said, the oil and gas industry there are all sorts of problems that to some degree they're ignoring right now. They're whatever, somebody will figure it out at some point. But to integrate all of these new observations into safety and environmental regulations will be a huge change. People say it'll cost too much money, it'll give us too much information, how do we deal with all of this? But yeah, it will change the way we actually solve the problems that we're currently dealing with.
You know, you alluded to cell phones earlier, and you know, it is then, you know, another set of capabilities that you can begin to take for granted on the part of the users who will be out there in the field, huh? That, okay, you know, we are now at a time when, let's talk stereotypes. We are now at a time when our average lineman is 37 years old. That means that our average lineman has grown up in an era when she or he has had this kind of technology in their lives for this long. And so we can take as givens these kinds of capabilities. I mean, that's part of the design of the socio-technical system, isn't it?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And what is the level of interest of kind of using new tools, right? That all of the manuals that teach a lineman how to deal with power lines does not, and it doesn't include drones, right? It doesn't include all of these tools that are coming. But they have more experience with technology that allows us to visualize at least what could come in the near future. A lot of work is being done right now on AR, VR of specifically like lineman type things, right? Yeah. When you're out at a utility pole, you could put on a visor, you could put on a goggle set and be able to see some of these things in real time and log it and describe it and put attributes on each of these features. And some people are totally gung-ho about that, but there's still a lot of distance to travel before it is an assumed tool. And in some cases, it might not be the right choice for kind of standard activities. So if your job is to look for very particular problems, like an arborist dealing with cutting trees back from power lines, only some of that will be enhanced with technology. There is still all of this institutional knowledge of like how do trees grow, what looks healthy, what looks diseased, like how do you cut a tree so that it actually will grow in the right direction. There are all of these kind of like there's this institutional understanding of how this stuff works and skills that people have that won't be enhanced with technology. So you have to really kind of balance all of those things.
This is a great, really, I think a great way for us to wrap up our conversation. And that is that, you know, RoboPsych has always been a place where we talk about those human robot, human technology interactions. And here you're talking about, as we talked about with people in healthcare, where Carla was part of a team that designed a robot to work alongside nurses who have all of that kind of tacit, implicit knowledge of the environment, of the workplace, of the patient, just as you're describing the arborist having all of that institutional tacit knowledge of what makes trees tick, basically, and how they work. And as always, it's at that point of interface between the human and the technology that the real opportunity lies. And so I hope you've got some great people on your team who are helping to work on those interface kinds of issues, because that's the place to me where the real opportunity is going to help us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and making all the technology meaningful.
Totally. Yeah, it's fun to to operate in these environments because you do need all sorts of different skill sets and perspectives in order to make it work. A technology problem at this point, like robots, is to some degree roboticists that are interested in, like, how does ROS work appropriately on the platform that you choose, but also people who can, electrical engineers who can design the sensors that are that operate in the right way and are resilient in the environments in which they'll be placed, people who understand the data in order to actually turn that into useful information, people who understand kind of supply chain issues and how you put that all together. So rolling out a program like the robot program is it's cool because you have to have all these different perspectives and you need people who are skilled at very different things in order to make it all work.
And this is where I would always put in a pitch for the designers like Carla and for the anthropological psychologists like myself, who are also able to help to bring all of that material together. Well, so Scott Nowicki, thanks so much for being a guest today on the RoboPsych podcast. I'm sure our listeners are going to enjoy this fascinating conversation about a great domain. So again, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. It was a great conversation.
Thanks for having me. It was pretty interesting.